We are going to hear from three guests this hour with different views on the American Health Care Act, the GOP plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our first guest will explain why she says the Republican plan is not real repeal. Our second guest discusses why he calls the proposal a step in the right direction. Finally, our last guest weighs in with why she claims the GOP plan will raise premiums and make the individual insurance market unstable. And we will welcome your questions and your views, including your reaction to the Congressional Budget Office's analysis of the American Health Care Plan, which was released yesterday, the one that says more people will be uninsured under the proposal and premium hikes will hit everyone initially and financially hurt older, lower-income individuals even more. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our first guest is Genevieve Wood, a senior fellow in communications and senior contributor to the Daily Signal, which is the Heritage Foundation's multimedia news organization. Her recent piece is titled Five Reasons the GOP's Obamacare Plan Isn't Real Repeal. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
How disappointed are you in the Republicans' health care plan?
Quite disappointed, and I'll tell you why. Not only does it not do what I think it should do, it's really disappointing when you know that people know what to do and that they've actually done much of it before, and then when they get the real opportunity to follow through on a promise they've made, they choose not to, and that's what's happened here. House Republicans, back in 2015, passed a reconciliation bill dealing with repealing much of Obamacare that was much stronger, had much more teeth in it than what they've recently suggested. The United States Senate, led by Republicans, also passed that measure. The challenge then was that you had a president, President Obama, who wasn't willing to, understandably, because he was for Obamacare, wasn't willing to sign it. Now that they have a president who would be willing to sign it, they've come back with a much weaker version of that bill. So that's disappointing because, as I said, I think they know what to do, but they've decided now that they actually have the power and a president willing to follow through, they're not using it.
Yeah, so why do you think that is?
Well, it's a good question, and maybe the folks of Wisconsin can further ask Paul Ryan that question. Look, I know that the president talked about on the campaign trail that he wanted to repeal and replace. And I think part of the problem here is that they're trying to do it all in one piece of legislation. And I think that's an improper way to go about it. I think they should repeal the bill, the Obamacare first, and then go about the replacement measure. When you do the repeal, you can put in 2 years or 3 years of, you know, whatever time is needed to transfer people or allow people to move from one insurance plan to another. So you can put precautionary measures in there. But if you're building a replacement on top of a very faulty foundation, which is what I think they're doing by not fully repealing Obamacare, you may end up with a different mess, but it's still a mess. And I think that's the chief complaint here is that Republicans have left much of the current structure of Obamacare in place with this new repeal that they're talking about. You know, what's driving up the cost of health care insurance premiums primarily are the mandates that the Obamacare legislation put on insurers and saying you must cover these different types of things, whether people want that coverage or that type of coverage or not, they must have it. And that costs a lot of money. Republicans have largely left that infrastructure in place. And so you can Band-Aid over here and Band-Aid over there, but at the end of the day, you still have the basic same structure, and you're still going to have a mess, and you're still going to have higher premiums, which I think at the end of the day will be how many people judge whether or not this turned out to be a successful repeal and replace. Mm. Did their health care premiums come down? And under this legislation, I don't think they're going to be able to say that for a long time.
Well, why is it so important to completely repeal Obamacare at this point?
Well, because if you're starting with, as I said, with a faulty foundation, you don't have a faulty foundation and try to build a house on top of that. You want to have a solid foundation. And I think that by leaving that infrastructure in place, the insurance mandates that have been, as I said, the driver of the premium soaring that we've seen in recent years. If you leave that structure in place, there's really no way to bring those premiums down. I mean, you can say, well, we're going to give more tax subsidies and we're going to try to roll back some on Medicaid, but at the end of the day, you're just kind of moving the numbers around and shuffling around. You're not truly reforming the system. So while I think in the long term, and I know that CBO came out with a report yesterday, you would see the federal budget deficit slightly come down. You would see in about 10 years from now, some of the healthcare premiums come down. That's far too long to wait, and it still doesn't provide the choice in the market Republicans promised when they were running this past year. Mm-hmm. Now, I know the president and Paul Ryan and others have said, we're going to get to erasing the state line so that people can have a more open market with health care in the future. But that'll be, they say, step three of this legislative process. I'm not really sure why they think they'll be able to get Democrats to go along with them at that point, why they aren't trying to do that up front. And secondly, again, with a repeal and replace bill, trying to do it all at once, this is one of the very things that Republicans complained about when Democrats rushed through Obamacare back in 2009, was that it was too much in one bill. It was massive. No one had time to read it. We didn't really have time to debate it. The American people didn't have time to learn what was in it. And to a certain extent, I would say that's what you have Republicans doing right now, at least the House leadership, putting a massive bill together, a repeal and a replace, as opposed to saying, we're just going to repeal, and then we're going to debate with everybody on both sides and the American people included, how we go about strengthening our healthcare system. But we're going to start from square one. We're not going to try to build on something that we already know is not working.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org if you'd like to ask a question or weigh in on the health care debate that we are having now. Our guest is Genevieve Wood, who is with the Daily Signal, the Heritage Foundation's multimedia news organization. Her recent piece is titled, Five Reasons the GOP's Obamacare Plan Isn't Real Repeal. Our next guest is going to say that the House plan is a good step, first step toward health care reform. He says it addresses a lot of the concerns that are troubling for conservatives, such as the individual mandate to buy insurance, taxes on insurers, medical device makers, and drug companies, and subsidies. So what about that, Genevieve? Seems like there's a lot of things taken away that you might not have liked.
Well, there's some good things in there for sure, but I would argue that some of those are the easy things. And, I mean, even if you talk about the subsidies portion, yes, they take away the subsidies that the Obamacare plan included, but they create their own new entitlement, if you will, via tax credits. So you can call it subsidies, you can call it tax credits, but at the end of the day, the federal government is subsidizing health care costs for far more folks than it should, and at higher rates than it should. And I think that's an important point to get into here. I mean, that kind of transfers into the Medicaid expansion issue. You know, through Obamacare, many states signed up for Medicaid expansion because the federal government said for a number of years, we will give you more money for those folks on Medicaid if you will sign them up than we're currently giving you as a matching rate for people currently on Medicaid. And there's two problems with that. Not only does that burden the Medicaid rolls, they were already overburdened to a great extent, and does it, you know, pass on a huge bill for the government, for state budgets down the road and for taxpayers, but it actually hurts the very people that Medicaid was originally intended for. I mean, Medicaid was intended to help the disabled and the elderly, women with children. It was intended to help the poor, the truly needy. But when we've expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, it's been expanded to able-bodied adults who basically don't have a job and so therefore don't have health care, but it doesn't require any type of work requirements. It doesn't require that they be seeking to get a job. It doesn't require anything else of them, and they're able-bodied. And what happens? Those folks are actually getting now Medicaid dollars that were intended for the truly needy. That doesn't mean the truly needy aren't also continuing to get Medicaid, but they're not getting the same level of services. It's steering money away from those who really need it to those who probably could find another way. If we could find another way to help them get health care, first of all, we would be requiring them to work and the like to achieve these benefits, which right now we're not. So I think it's got an adverse built-in component here that really ought to be talked about. And if you look at the way states have handled this issue, I would encourage people to look at the state of Maine. We have an article on the Daily Signal today about that very issue, how they have tried to transfer people who don't, who really need Medicaid. They tried to keep the program and make it better for them. But people who are able-bodied adults who are 40 years old or 45 years old who don't have children, them being placed into the same program and given the same benefits has really created a burden on the system. And now the truly needy aren't getting the kind of care that they need. I would encourage people to look at what Maine has done there to deal with that issue. But again, the Republican plan does not deal with that. It allows states to continue Medicaid expansion for the next 2 to 3 years. At that point, it would start dealing with it, but that's far too late.
We will leave it there for now. Thank you very much for being with us. Genevieve Wood is the Senior Fellow in Communications and Senior Contributor to the Daily Signal. When we come back from news, we will hear from another guest with a different perspective on the health care plan. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with different guests who have different perspectives on the American Health Care Act, the GOP plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. Our first guest explained why she said that this plan is not real repeal, and talked about how disappointed she was in the GOP plan. Now we will hear from a guest who says that it is a step in the right direction. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions and reactions to at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our next guest is Paul Howard, a senior fellow and director of health policy at the Manhattan Institute, co-author of the book Unlocking Precision Medicine. His column, How to Improve the House GOP's American Health Care Act, appeared last week in the New York Daily News, and we have posted it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So why do you call the House plan a step in the right direction for health care reform?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, the administration and Congress's first concern has to be how to stabilize the individual insurance markets right now, which in most states are under serious pressure or in free fall. Insurance rates went up by about a quarter last year. Stabilization has peaked, I think, at around 11 million people, which is far below CBO estimates, Congressional Budget Office estimates at this point of, I think, around 16 million people from a year or so ago. And four out of the five largest insurers have either totally pulled out or have pulled out of almost all the exchanges. So it's under pressure. I think that the challenge that the GOP is trying to address is how do you get younger and healthier people back into this market? If you can get enough young and healthy people to sign up for coverage, that lowers premiums for everyone. And this bill attempts to do that with a couple of mechanisms, like expanding what are called the age rating bands, which allows insurers to charge, up to one-fifth of what they charge older consumers, and tightening up what are called the special enrollment periods in the law. So one thing that the Obama administration does they probably regret right now is allowing a number of exemptions from the individual mandate that essentially gave people a free pass to sit out the exchange for any one of a number of hardship exemptions, or let them drop coverage and then buy it later, which a lot of insurers have complained about, that people are waiting until they get sick to buy coverage or need insurance, then they get care, and then they drop out again. It's creating a lot of problems in the market. The problem with the GOP bill is that I think the age, just linking subsidies, the tax credits in the bill to age, is not as useful as it needs to be, because you have to get the low income, have to have enough support in the bill to get low income people to sign up. And that's really my biggest criticism of the law, is that you have to think not just about the age effects, but also the distributional effects when it comes to income, and ensure that there's enough support for low income Americans under the law, who, for instance, might lose Medicaid coverage, but could then get a tax credit and actually buy insurance.
Let me get you right away to react to a listener, Matt Nwassa, who emailed. He says, we are becoming the laughingstock of the world relative to health care. He goes on to say, the debate has degenerated to the point where we are simply arguing to what degree the poor and the elderly should be allowed to suffer. What's your reaction to that?
Right. I mean, look, the U.S. is one of the most generous nations in the world when it comes to healthcare spending. Arguably, you know, not arguably, we just do. We spend more money than anyone else. The U.S. government, just its federal programs, Medicare and the joint state-federal program, Medicaid, you know, probably spend up in the top five of the OECD countries, our wealthy peer competitors when it comes to health care. But we've created this, and here's where I agree, we created this kind of hybrid system where if you get insurance through your employer, you're very well protected, but if you don't, you go without coverage and you're purchasing it at a sharp increase to those rates. And that's a problem. It's unfair, and I think that, you know, both parties have, you know, moved in the direction of we've got to find some way to offer coverage to those people. I think the House bill is trying to address the insurance concerns about driving young people out of the market, but at the same time, you want to get the subsidies right. I think we're getting there. We're almost there. And I'd also say about this House bill, you have to think of it as, you know, as the president has said and Secretary Price has said, it's part of a three-part effort. There's really only a relatively narrow window of things they can do in this bill that affect subsidy design. So I think that that's one of the biggest things they can focus on, but there are other things in terms of regulations they're going to have to try and get done later, including with Democratic support.
Well, our last guest from the Heritage Foundation was arguing that Republicans should fully repeal Obamacare before introducing any replacements, and there could be some sort of transition time, she said. But you can't build a health care plan on a faulty foundation. What is your thought as to why the Affordable Care Act wasn't fully repealed?
Well, I think that the reason, well, we have to define what we mean by fully repealed. So, you know, the strategy of the Republicans originally was to do a full repeal, repealing the subsidies in a few years, in 2019 or 2020. And then after they did a full repeal through reconciliation, then move on to a repeal and replace, full repeal and replace legislation. The problem with that, and the reason people were getting, you know, anxious, maybe panicking isn't quite the right word, but it's almost the right word, is that, you know, you see all of this dissension in the Republican ranks right now. You know, people on the far right, like the Freedom Caucus, are saying, gosh, we don't want any refundable tax credits. That creates a new entitlement. And other moderate and centrist Democrats are saying, no, we have to have one. We have to have one to help people buy coverage. And so the party is splitting. And I think that if you do repeal first without the replace part, or at least this isn't even full replace, this is like repeal plus, if you do that, then you're splitting the caucus again because all of those people are walking away. And if you repeal all of the, you know, ACA taxes and everything before you have put together a replacement plan, the danger is that all the industries, you know, all the factions that can't agree with each other will walk away, and it will make it incredibly hard to come up with any kind of true replacement plan. And that it also takes away any incentive Democrats have to come to the negotiating table at some point, because they can just say, look, you've stripped the whole thing out. You know, any, you know, effects on this are on you. You basically built an Obamacare cliff, and now you're going to walk over it, and we'll let you do that.
Yeah. What's your reaction to the Congressional Budget Office analysis that came out yesterday that shows 24 million more Americans would be uninsured by 2026?
Right. Here again, you've got to, you know, work on the distributional effects of the law. I mean, no one wants to see an additional 24 million people go without coverage, largely because one effect you saw from the individual mandate is it does encourage people to sign up for coverage, even coverage for which they were already eligible. So a lot of people are eligible for Medicaid, but a lot of times they just don't bother showing up. And I think that's probably because the design of the program is not a great fit for what people actually need, but still they did get coverage. I think the Republicans need to go back probably on the Senate side and make some changes, to the what's called the Patient and State Stabilization Fund, which is a fund of about $100 billion in the law right now that would allow states to create a reinsurance fund or a number of other reforms at the state level that would help bring premiums down. I think that fund probably needs to be expanded a good bit. Maybe instead of, you know, $10 billion a year, maybe it goes up to $16 or $15 billion a year to make that fund really stable. And then I think that could really have a serious downward effect on premiums if states were to use it for, you know, some kind of reinsurance program. To take the highest cost patients off of insurers' books and help bring down premiums for everybody else, and then get the individual mandate right. Whatever you're putting in place of the ACA's individual mandate, it's got to have some teeth. Right now, the 30% penalty for not carrying coverage, it's in the Republican bill, probably isn't adequate to get young people to sign up and keep coverage. So, you know, both offering bigger carrots to the states to bring down costs, you know, and ensure that that lower income people can truly access affordable coverage, and then, you know, put some teeth back in there and ensure that, you know, everybody's got a strong incentive to sign up for coverage. And if they don't do it, you know, when they need to and help keep everyone's rates low, there's going to be a serious financial penalty.
And the CBO report also predicted that premiums will jump 20% for the next couple of years, or 2018, 2019, but after that they would start decreasing. However, it says that premiums would be higher for particularly older people with lower incomes. Is that fair?
Look, it's one of the things that I'm worried about. So, you know, I think what you do, if you can get, I mean, the sweet spot here is, so right now we have a situation where premiums are going up by 24% and young people are staying out of the market in droves. And that raises premiums for young people. So, you know, compared to pre-ACA rates, rates are just up across the board for everyone. If you're at or below about 150% of the federal poverty level, relatively poor or low income, you get very generous subsidies under the Affordable Care Act that basically make the care, you know, either free or close to free for you. If you're above that, you're paying quite a bit out of pocket. We're seeing more people drop coverage and stay out of coverage. If you bring those healthy people back into the market, everyone's rates can come down. So I think that that's the biggest challenge Republicans need to be focused on. I think that in a well-designed market, we can see two things. We can see young people come back in because the rates are lower for them, and then older people will only face slightly marginal costs because those young people bring down, again, premiums for everyone. And then you look at the distributional effects, and you do target income subsidies for people at the low income end. So if there are high earners who are paying a little bit more at the margins because they're older, that's okay. Older Americans actually have the lowest rate of poverty of any of the demographic groups. So being older allows you more time to accumulate wealth, even if it does mean you're probably sicker on average. But there's some way that we can balance this out and ensure that everybody has access to affordable insurance.
Mark in Sheboygan is with us. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. Happy Pi Day, by the way. My question is, and I don't, by the way, I don't agree with your guess that we are leading, you know, on how much money we spend on patients for healthcare and stuff. All other industrialized nations leave us in the dust. And no other industrialized nation on the face of the planet pays a CEO $181,000 a day, every day of the year, to be president of United Healthcare. Well, my question is, if I was interviewing anybody on healthcare, pro or con, you know, Genevieve, your first guest, this guest, your next guest, Paul Ryan, whatever, my first question to them would be, how do you get your health care? Do you sleep well at night? Do you worry about losing your health care? Are all your family members covered? How do you get it yourself? Yeah. And get a little empathy going there. So I don't know how this guest gets his health care, but I would like to know.
Well, that's not necessarily the question that you said you were going to ask, but I mean, we are getting a lot of calls saying, why doesn't Congress just give the American people the benefits, the insurance benefits that Congress gets? And his question about empathy, I guess, is a fair one, Paul. So, I mean, it's easier said than done.
You know, to his first point, the U.S. spends about $10,000 per capita on health insurance, about twice the average that other countries spend. It's not that we're not extraordinarily generous. One could argue, in fact, that the reason we spend so much, part of it, because we've tied insurance to employment and we have open-ended spending for other programs like Medicare and Medicaid. That's kind of neither here nor there, but because everything else is so expensive, it makes any time you try and expand coverage to other groups extraordinarily expensive. And we've got this, fraction of the population, about 15%. It's not even the same 15%, because somebody who's very young, you know, gets out of college, maybe they're on their parents' coverage for a while, then they're not, and then for a couple of years, maybe they're working at a small graphics firm, and they don't have coverage, and then they get to a big firm, and then they have coverage again. So the part of the population that doesn't have insurance is always churning out. This even includes Medicaid. People get coverage. People drop coverage. Even when it's available to them, they don't take it up. It's a transient population. But what I would say for this, you know, I'm part of the 160 million people or so who gets coverage through their employment. And I do think that it's unfair that somebody who doesn't have access to employer-based coverage doesn't at least have an affordable way to access coverage for the few years or for the time that they're going to be working independently for themselves or however it is. The way that I think a lot of economists have thought about this is you cap the exclusion for employer-provided health insurance and you use the savings from that at the very high end to help subsidize folks, people at the back end. The ACA does something like that. It's imperfect. It's called the Cadillac tax. It's in the law. A lot of big companies hate it. But we should probably keep it or build in some similar function that's a little more clean into the law that, again, gets some of that savings and you can redistribute it to people who don't have employer-based coverage. That's a relatively elegant way that people have agreed, yes, we can try and expand coverage of this population. I think the real thorny thing here, as always, is the cost, again, because the costs are so high. So, you know, when the ACA was originally passed, people estimated it would cost about $1 trillion over 10 years. The true cost is actually closer to $2 trillion. And we're still not going to cover everyone under the law. Even if Republicans did nothing, the ACA will still leave about 20 to 25 million people uninsured. So it's not a silver bullet. And I think, you know, for the most part, both parties are trying to get this right.
Yeah. And here we have Heidi asks, why can't Congress come up with a plan like they have? Which, I mean, they're getting employer-based health care, too, aren't they? And their employer is us?
Right. Their employer, you know, I believe, I haven't looked at this in a few years, but it's the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program. So federal employees get a fairly generous buy-in, like a lot of employees do at big companies. 90% of companies, I think, with 500 or more employees offer health insurance, and it's relatively generous. So, you know, I think that when you say that, let's let them buy in. I mean, there are all sorts of ways of thinking about this problem. I don't know why that never got done. I'm sure there were, you know, some philosophical objections on the right to doing that. There might have been some objections on the left because the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan, I'm sure their enrollees are relatively young and healthy being federal employees, and if you move a different population to that, you could have seen their rates go up. So that might be one reason why that doesn't get done. The other thing I'd point out is that, you know, the states are also in a very good position to figure out what their populations need. Some states are struggling with opiate addiction issues. You know, other populations have different needs. One thing that I do support on the Republican end is, like, look, let's give the states more tools to address their own state populations, because really there are 50 different state problems. Maybe in some states it's really let's help, you know, small businesses expand coverage. In another state it might be another solution. But these are the things that we're struggling with. I mean, I think that, you know, going through the ACA, what you've seen is, you know, it's a complicated problem. It's not simply a failure of will. There's certainly some of that. But it's really high cost in some cases, and you've got to figure out this sweet spot. The reason the ACA didn't get a lot of younger people enrolled is because the coverage is very expensive, and the president and the Democratic Congress also watered down the individual mandate to the point where it was extraordinarily weak and people sat it out.
We have just a minute. I'm sorry, Paul. We have just a minute to go. How confident are you that Republicans who are divided on this issue are going to wind up on the same page and get something accomplished?
Well, I think they're under tremendous pressure to get something done. I think this bill is going to get over to the Senate, and then I expect the Senate to make changes on it. Can they get it to the point where, you know, the House and the Senate are going to agree? I think that's a tough hill to climb right now, but it's a little too hard to look into the future. I'd say that, you know, there's a 50-50 chance right now they'll get something done, and we're just going to have to see what happens.
Thank you very much for being with us. Paul Howard is a senior fellow, director of health policy at the Manhattan Institute, co-author of the book Unlocking Precision Medicine, and his column How to Improve the House GOP's American Health Care Act appeared last week in the New York Daily News. All right, two perspectives down, one to go. We will come back and talk with another guest with another view on the GOP health care plan. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are getting different perspectives on the Republican health care plan during this hour. We already heard from a guest who was disappointed in the American Health Care Act, a conservative guest from the Heritage Foundation, said this is not real repeal. Then we heard from a guest who said that the GOP plan is a step in the right direction, though he did have some tweaks that he would make to the plan. Now our next guest weighs in on why she says this American Health Care Act will raise premiums and make the individual insurance market unstable, and we will continue welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our next guest is Sarah Leek, Senior Policy Analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She focuses on health reform implementation, especially health insurance exchanges and private market reforms in the Affordable Care Act. She is also a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Her recent piece is titled, House GOP Proposed Penalty for Non-Coverage Fails on Several Fronts. And we have posted that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, as well as our previous guests' writings on this. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
So, I guess just what is your overall impression of this House Republicans' health care plan?
Well, I think the big concern is that it would leave 24 million people over a decade uninsured after we've just made so much progress in bringing the uninsured rate down to historic levels and helping many, many millions of people access health care that they need at an affordable price. Mm-hmm. So that's the overall, I think, bad story about what's going on here. People would see their subsidies, if they're getting marketplace coverage now, slashed, and the out-of-pocket costs under their plans, like their deductibles, would be much, much higher. So I think it's hard to watch after so much progress has been made to have that kind of thing looming.
The CBO report, as you mentioned, said by 2026, 24 million more Americans would be uninsured under this House plan. House Speaker Paul Ryan, though, said over the weekend in anticipation of the report that because there is not a government mandate, he's saying understandable. Sure, there are going to be fewer people who have insurance. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what's going on in terms of the coverage loss is because people wouldn't have access to affordable coverage anymore. I think definitely there is that impact as well of no longer having an individual mandate that we have now, which is a pretty broad requirement. It applies to pretty much anybody who goes without insurance for more than a couple of months would pay a penalty on their taxes, on their tax returns. With the House bill, they're doing away with that, which could have a substantial impact on people's decisions going forward about whether to have coverage. And what they're putting in its place, they're calling it a continuous coverage requirement, but it's really a late enrollment penalty. And it only applies to a subset of people. So unlike today's penalty, this penalty would apply only to those people who have a gap in coverage of more than a couple months and then try to get coverage in the individual market or in the small group market through a small business. So those folks who've had a gap can't show that they've had continuous coverage for the prior 12 months would pay a 30% higher premium rate on their coverage for as long as they continue to buy it. So it's a narrower penalty in terms of who it would hit. Some people who are having gaps in coverage but ultimately are able to get access to employee benefits through their job at a large employer wouldn't have to pay a penalty ever, even if they'd gone without coverage for any length of time. And then I think the real concern going forward, and CBO's score bears this out, a couple million more people, they're saying each year, a couple million fewer people would have coverage each year going forward under this kind of penalty. And the reason for that is that people who are going to be buying an individual market or small group market who've had a gap, they're going to have to everybody's going to have to prove that they've had continuous coverage. So you're going to have to come up with that paperwork. And then if you did have a gap, you'd have to pay a higher premium for up to 12 months. So those are both deterrent effects. Either I have to pay a higher premium if I've had a gap, or even if I haven't had a gap, I have to go and come up with all this paperwork to show that I didn't have a gap. And frankly, that's just not something a healthy person is going to be as likely to want to do.
Yeah. The CBO also said premiums would likely rise by 20% in the individual insurance market by 2018 and 2019, but then start to decrease. And by 2026, they would be roughly 10% less than they are now. So what's your reaction to that?
I mean, I think that's a number that many of the Republicans are pointing to today, because it sounds good that you'd have somewhat lower premiums going forward in the future. But the story that doesn't tell, it's really important for people to remember, is that's really talking about sort of the base price, the sticker price of health insurance, but it doesn't take into account those big cuts in the subsidies, the tax credits that the House plan has. So the CBO is finding that by 2026, about 50% of the average subsidy that people get under current law would be reduced. So that is a really big concern in terms of affordability. In addition, it looks like people would be paying more for less because their deductibles would be much higher and people would be paying much more out of pocket. So even though their premiums are lower, the actual value of the health insurance that they're buying would be less. So it might sound nice to have a 10% premium reduction, but it's not going to be a great affordable story for a lot of people in the market.
We have full lines. Let's go to Paul in Mosinee. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just don't understand why they don't make the insurance companies not for profit like it is in Switzerland and the Netherlands and make them compete for true health care instead of paying the United Health guy $120 million a year. You ever had United Health and tried to get stuff prior off, you know, that's just obscene. Sorry.
I'm actually going to take another call because it's somewhat similar. Francisco in Sister Bay, go ahead.
Thank you and good morning. I'm a very knowledgeable guy. I have a PhD, two doctorates, okay, so I know what I'm talking about. If we could give every American the same policy or same insurance coverage that we give the politicians, the politicians would vote for it. Now, what I'm saying really is revoke the health policies of the politicians until every American gets that same coverage. It's very simple as that, and don't start another war.
All right. Thank you, Francisco. It wasn't exactly the same, but all right. Make insurance not for profit. Why can't we do that, Sarah?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's an idea that's always been floating out there, right, that there's other models that we could try. I think what we're dealing with now is a situation where we haven't gotten agreement on what we should do going forward. And unfortunately, a lot of that has to do with maybe because people haven't really realized what's already there in the Affordable Care Act. And I'm hopeful that warnings like the CBO score about how damaging the House proposal could be will give people pause and make people think about what they want the market to look like going forward. But suffice it to say, it's not going to be any simpler under the House bill to buy insurance. It's not going to be affordable for many, many people. So that's a loss.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, we can't. There's all sorts of people who say, "Let's do Medicare for all. Let's do single payer. Give us what Congress gets." But that's not what's being debated right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to look at what's right in front of us, and I'm hopeful that that people can hang on to the affordable coverage that they've managed to get over the recent years.
Yeah, but a lot of people would say it's not all that affordable. Affordable. Why do you say that the Affordable Care Act really was affordable?
Well, for many people, because we're at a historic low in terms of uninsurance. So between the Medicaid expansion in many states and the access to the individual insurance market being broader and easier for people to get than ever before, for many people, it did become much more affordable because between tax credits that help people buy their insurance, as well as the other subsidy that people sometimes forget about, which is cost-sharing reductions from the federal government through the marketplaces that actually reduce people's deductibles and out-of-pocket costs, it made things so much better than it was before. And I say that because a lot of people who, don't have job-based health benefits or other access, they're not low-income enough to access the Medicaid program, for instance. Before the ACA, they didn't have a place to get insurance. And what the ACA did is for those people who need another place to buy insurance, it actually made that individual market more accessible. So
I agree. It didn't make it affordable for everybody, but it made it affordable for millions more people, and then it made it sure that they could also afford their out-of-pocket costs if they had moderate and low incomes.
Yeah. Well, so, there's certainly a lot of disagreement on the Republican side as well how to proceed with health care reform. What would you like them to keep in mind as they hash out what to do?
Well, I think what's amazing, it's such a complex subject, and I think a lot of people maybe before the debate has really started this time around hadn't really engaged in the details of what the law meant, and now that we see what it has done and how it's helped so many people, I'm hopeful that policymakers will take a close look at how to hold on to the gains that have been made and to avoid going backwards or even to making things worse. It's really important for people to know that they have a place they can access coverage, that if they fall on hard times, that there's a way for them to get coverage that protects them and their families from really high out-of-pocket expenses and make sure they can get access. So I think there's really been an outcry from people about the importance of that, and I'm hoping that legislators will hear that and will tread very carefully in terms of ruining what we've already been able to accomplish.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Leek, Senior Policy Analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Her piece, House GOP Proposed Penalty for Non-Coverage Fails on Several Levels, is posted on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Prior to that, we heard from Paul Howard, who is with the Manhattan Institute. His piece, How to Improve the House GOP's American Health Care Act, is also posted on our Facebook page. And prior to that, we heard from Genevieve Wood, who is with the Heritage Foundation, and her piece, Five Reasons the GOP's Obamacare Plan is Not Real Repeal, is also posted. Thank you to Bill Martins and to Nyasia Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.